Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I am Bob Hill.
And today on the show, we have Mr. Chip Tynan from Mobot.
Our go-to guy, Missouri Botanic Garden, a neat place.
And, yeah, fabulous place.
And being fall, we're interested in perhaps the best trees and shrubs for fall color and bark and that kind of stuff. And Chip Tynan knows about everything.
Yep.
And he's going to have some suggestions. So get your pencil and paper ready, folks, and take down some notes on the best trees and shrubs and for fall color.
And then keep the pencil handy.
Yeah.
And make sure that you take notes, because arborist Greg Mills is coming into the studio to talk to us about proper planting techniques.
Of these wonderful fall trees, colored trees and shrubs.
Yeah. Certified arborist. He's actually city arborist in New Albany. And I saw him speak once, and he was so dynamic, and he had all these great props, Bob, of like, you know, trees that were just mangled, you know, like after they were cut down, or, you know, pulling the roots out of the ground intact so people could see what was really going on. So he was really able to drive his points home really well with all of his fabulous props.
And some of his other points, of course, are we get trees from the nursery industry that need help. It's not always the homeowner's fault that trees die. They come in the container. They have serious problems from the get-go, too tight or plant too deep in the container, and he'll explain how to deal with that situation,
too. Yeah, it's extremely valuable information, so we hope that you'll stick with us today on Homegrown. Right. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
This is the season and the reason we live in this area, this beautiful falls we have in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. So these are just orders to people. Go outside and sit on a bench under a tree. Mm-hmm. That's an order. Go kick some leaves. That's an order.
But kick them underneath the canopy of the tree.
That's an order, too. Go take a walk and take your camera with you. Just, you know, fall is so fabulous around here.
It really is.
If you haven't done it already, you know, we're getting a little close to the Thanksgiving and you lose some of the stuff. But for God's sakes, put down your job and go outside and enjoy nature.
The sky is bluer this time of the year.
Yeah, this kind of brittle sunlight you get.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Yeah, and I've now got to see three falls. I was in Minnesota.
That's right.
I saw it. I was in Illinois, and I saw it, and now I get to see it again. So
in
it's
Kentucky.
My third fall.
In Indiana.
And I've loved all three of them.
Excellent.
It's perfect.
Great.
How about the Wishes State? What's up?
Well, this is just a little tip.
Okay. I'm taking notes.
Do not leave animal feed in your car with the window open enough for a raccoon to get in.
Oh, no. There's a story here.
Okay, I've always known that it's not a good idea to leave, like, Laina or dog food bags or chicken food feed bags, like, in the back of my station wagon, right?
How about McDonald's bags?
That, too. Because mice can get in there. My sister had some mice problems from leaving horse feed bags in the trunk of her car.
Yeah.
Like in her car. She had mice living in her car. Yeah. So I learned from her a long time ago not to do that. But I've had this little Ziploc bag of cat food. Don't ask me why. Little Ziploc bag of cat food in my car for, you know, a couple weeks now.
I won't ask you why.
And so I get in the car the other day and I'm like,
Oh,
smells like somebody just got a pizza. You know how that sort of smell?
Or worse.
And I turn around and somebody had torn open this little bag of food. And I thought, Then I looked and I noticed there were little paw prints on the window and on my steering wheel. So it was open enough for this raccoon to get in. So, okay, last night I had got the food out, and I made sure the windows were closed. Boy, Mr. Rocky Raccoon, he was all over my car, and the passenger window, my window that had been cracked, is all smeared and scratched and smudged because he's trying to get back in again.
Right.
So anyway, do not leave pet food in your car with the window cracked.
We've had that in the barn. We closed the barn up for the winter at Hidden Hill, and there's been a couple of years when the raccoons got in.
And just took up residence.
Well, they knock things over, they look for things. Mm-hmm. So it's the same situation. Raccoons would run the world if they were a little bigger.
Yeah.
And could vote.
And they could vote. And they're so great because they wash their hands after they eat.
Yeah. But the same deal, the footprints. And we use traps, and they're friendly traps.
Mm-hmm. We've trapped. Have a heart.
Yeah, we've trapped 3 or 4 raccoons. I take them over to your place and let them go. Have you seen them?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. One in your
Drove
car.
My car away the other day. Thanks a lot.
I do trap them because you have to.
Oh, well, I guess that's what I get for my new quail license plate that I finally got. You know, have we talked about that?
Yeah.
And it's the words on it are, you know, supporting wildlife. So my car is, in fact, supporting wildlife.
And speaking of wildlife, we've heard apparently from Brainerd Pommelball again about the hummingbird situation.
We have. Brainerd emailed me saying, all in all, the hummers should be gone by now. So if you notice any hummingbirds out around your garden, it could possibly be the elusive rufous hummer or another western species.
Right.
So Brainerd would like to know. So you can email us and let us know if you see any hummingbirds around your place, and then we can let Brainerd Pommelball know. Or you can check out the study group information by visiting hummingbirdsplus.org. All right.
And hummingbirds have that beautiful foliage you often find trees in the fall.
Yes, Bob, that's right.
And not only on hummingbirds, but a lot of these trees have a marvelous fall color that you should have in your yards. We've got a guy to help us out to name the trees and where to put them. He's Chip Tynan. He's horticultural information specialist and the main answer guy with the Missouri Botanic Garden in St. Louis. He's never met a garden question he couldn't answer, but today we'll give him another chance to try. Chip, welcome to Homegrown.
Oh, it's great to be back.
Okay, remind us a little bit about, you know, your background, how you got there, and Missouri Botanic itself. What's going on there?
Oh, me. Very, very long story made short. But, I started out in life to be an English teacher, and somewhere along the line I got sidetracked, and now I've become, I guess, what you could describe as a horticultural educator.
Right.
I supervise an office that fields gardening questions from local gardeners, or at least it used to be just local gardeners until the advent of the internet.
Right.
And now we wind up getting contacts literally from all over the country, and even some odd inquiries here and there from different places in the world. So
you've got a blog. We'll talk about it a little bit later, but Missouri Botanic itself, how big is it, and what will people find there?
79 acres. It's just jam-packed with plants, and we're what would be known among botanical gardens as a display garden. We focus on annual displays that are changed out seasonally. So, we're in autumn now, and our stunning summer displays that consist often mostly of tropical plants and annuals have been ripped out, tossed in the compost pile, and we've planted tulips in most cases, and we also top that off with pansies, and of course everything is color coordinated to the color scheme of next spring.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So we're transitioning from season to season now, and just pulled out, I think, the last of the dahlias today.
But in terms of your permanent collection, I bet you guys are starting to see some really fabulous fall color.
Well, we are. We're seeing nice fall color, and I had great hope for excellent fall color this year because we had a cool, moist summer.
Mm-hmm.
Where it was amazing. Every time we needed a rainfall, we got it. It was like we really got
summer.
An inch of rain a week. And, in some cases, we got a lot more than that,
mm-hmm.
unfortunately, because there was localized flooding. And and those areas are not coloring well at all.
Mm-hmm.
But as you come down the final glide into autumn, you hope to get crystal clear days, blue sunny skies, and cool crisp nights with temperatures that stay above freezing. And we got a lot of those blue sunny days, but our night temperatures stayed unseasonably warm.
Okay,
so that's affected the quality of our color.
So let's talk about the whole physiological process of fall color. What's going on in a tree as their leaves turn from green to yellow, red, orange, what have you?
As the green colors start to break down, and that's the chlorophyll. Chlorophyll production slows or halts as autumn approaches, and with the lack of green coloring, which masks many of the other colors in the leaves, and mm-hmm. the yellows start to show up. You know, if you ever bring in a house plant into the house, and the amount of light is not as good in the house, and the temperatures are all wrong, and then the leaves start to yellow.
Mm-hmm.
So as leaves are starting to die, then they go ahead and change to that yellow also. And so,
but it's a draining effect more than a change, I guess. Or as you said, the green was masking these colors that have always been there. Anyway.
Right, and then you have the anthocyanin factor, which is the chemical that can actually build up in the leaves in fall, regulated really by local weather conditions.
Okay.
Hmm. So again, that the cool, clear days and cool nightfall is what
is
promotes
the
concentrations of sugars and the productions of anthocyanins.
Okay, yeah. Okay, I'm a homeowner. I want this gorgeous fall color in my yard. What trees might you recommend for more or less guaranteed fall color?
I'll give you one right off the top, but most homeowners are going to be sorry that I even mentioned it. I think you know what's coming. Sweet gum.
Yeah. Oh, yes. But there are gumless sweet gums.
Well, there are. There are. Although, they're probably a better choice for you folks,
mm-hmm.
but not this far north in St. Louis.
Okay.
And we do have several of the rotunda loba form
right.
of the sweet gum.
Yeah.
And we found that there was significant damage when we had the freeze in around Easter time, 2007.
Right.
Right.
So for us, those trees are very vulnerable to late spring frost, severe late spring frost. They're also vulnerable to an early premature autumn freeze as well. So I believe that the original tree, I think, was actually discovered in the wild somewhere in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's adapted to areas of the country that have a longer growing season.
Okay. What are some other shade trees of that size with nice fall color?
Well, you know, it's not a native, but ginkgos, of course, right. You know, the classic yellow, just beautiful color. And the ginkgos have that quirky habit of holding all their leaves till rather late in the color season and then just seemingly dropping them all at once.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And literally, on many, many times over the years, I've walked past, we have several large ancient ginkgo trees near our Climatron geodesic greenhouse on the garden grounds. And the trees were yellow in the morning time and in the afternoon totally bare.
Mm-hmm.
So literally within just a few hours they can shed entirely.
Makes for efficient raking though, doesn't it?
Well, you know, interestingly, we have yew hedges planted right beneath those ginkgo trees.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
And the yews, of course, are vibrantly green.
Right.
And as the leaves come down, if it's not too windy a day, then you get this pile of yellow right on top of that green. And believe me, that's a wonderful photo op.
Oh, boy.
And one year we had autumn crocus, a stunning display of autumn crocus that was right at the base of the end of that scenario, at the end of the hedge. And apparently there were many, many gardeners who took pictures of that. And I remember getting a very disappointed call from a gentleman one year complaining that that the autumn crocus weren't flowering at the same time that the ginkgo leaves were falling on top of the hedge again.
Oh, wow.
How about
serendipity?
How about oaks and maples? Any particular choices for color?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, maples, red maples, October Glory, Rent Sunset, those are just two of the varieties that are just absolutely outstanding. And, you know, the oaks, they're a variable lot. But, of course, pin oaks, many of the, and red oaks, northern red oak and pin oak, can have outstanding russety reds that are not as, you know, knock your socks off, like like some of the ginkgos, for instance, and other other species. But subdued reds are excellent as well. And then they often retain their leaves and shed their leaves later than many other species.
I love black gum and tupelo too. Talk about that.
And black gum is a wonderful example. We have several old black gums in our collection, and one of the things that struck me over the years is that none of them drop their leaves at the same time as the others.
Oh, okay.
And we have one that is one of the first trees in our collections to drop their leaves. Always outstanding color. It's beautiful right now. By the time it's shed its leaves, we will only be getting to the peak of our fall season for other trees.
You know, Chip, they seem to be at the farm here. They seem to be the very first to take on some fall color, as you say, to kind of be finished up before everything else is at their peak. So,
that's very
harbinger
true.
Of autumn.
Although that is really variable, and this is somewhere where nurserymen could actually select black gums for their variable fall coloration. Mm-hmm. We have a row of six black gums that we've planted in very close proximity to each other. They're relatively young now, maybe about 10 years of age, and the idea is to create a clipped, pleached hedge out of black gum.
Cool.
And it's very, very cool, except that...
They're variable.
some are bare and some of them are brilliant and others are, are not as brilliant as the brilliant guys.
Right,
you know?
They're not cooperating together.
Yeah. So, it looks wonderful when they're all green together. It's great when the leaves come off in the winter. But that little transition season when you hope to knock people's socks off, planning went awry.
How about the Japanese maples? I love those in the yard.
Totally, absolutely. And of course, here at the Botanical Garden, we've got a very large Japanese garden, Seiwa-en, which is a Japanese strolling garden, and it's 14 acres, and it's just filled with Japanese maples. The wonderful thing about Japanese maples is that they're among the latest trees to change, and certainly to reach their peak of fall color. So I locally here in St. Louis, I'm always telling folks, go on out wherever you like and your favorite drives and enjoy the fall color. But if you come down here to our Japanese garden in November, you're going to get to see the last outstanding display of color by just taking a walk around the lake in that lovely garden. And it really is. It's we could have a bad year for fall color for many other trees, but those Japanese maples seem to perform year in, year out. Hmm.
So, Chip, how about some good shrubs for fall color?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And there's many viburnums that produce excellent fall color. Mm-hmm. The itias,
right?
The sweet spires have excellent fall color, and the itea is one of those plants that they're right there with the Japanese maples as providing some of the best late fall color.
How about Fothergillia?
No question about it. And actually, of course, there's so many cultivars of Gardenii, Fothergilla Gardenii, but I really think that the large Fothergilla, Fothergilla major, actually has even better fall color than the dwarf Fothergilla.
Yeah.
Wonderful plant. I think that's a very underutilized shrub in our home garden.
That's a neat plant. And then one last question. How about just the bark itself, winter bark? What's your favorites to look at when there's no leaves around left at all?
Well, a paper bark maple is one of the most wonderful trees. Mm-hmm. Ironwood, hop hornbeam, which is the Ostraea virginiana, is one of our native species. It has a lovely bark. I think that's another tree that's very overlooked. Persian ironwood or parodia, Persian parodia, outstanding flaking patches of bark. Lace bark pine is another one that it's coloration is very similar, reminiscent to me of Parodia.
Yeah, I like our Kentucky coffee tree. It's a deep fissured black
wonderful
bark and nice limb shape. It's really a neat plant.
You bet. Again, that's another one. It's, you know, I mean, it'll take over a whole yard, certainly, but
right.
it definitely should be planted more often in parks and large properties. And,
okay.
And then, you know, you've got these trees that have this, you know, muscular appearance to their to the trunks of their trees. And, you know, again, that's another reason to grow Japanese maples, especially Acer palmatum, the straight species forms.
Right.
Have that wonderful old muscular character to the to their bark. And
well, Chip, we thank you again. You're a fountain of information, and you don't mind spilling the water our way. We appreciate that.
Okie doke.
Thank you, Chip.
All right, great to talk to you guys.
Chip Tynan is a horticulture information specialist at the Missouri Botanic Garden in St. Louis. For more information on Chip or the garden, visit our homegrown page at wfpl.org.
Fall is a great time to plant trees and shrubs, and to make sure we do it all right, arborist Greg Mills joins us after the break. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I am Bob Hill. I hear a chainsaw in the distance.
I know.
Can that be
it can be.
First here in the studio?
Chainsaw, handsaw,
right.
B&B, container grown.
Pruners.
Everything.
Yep.
Everything.
Shovels.
This is the time of the year that's a really good time of the year to plant woody plants.
Absolutely.
And it occurred to me that one of the problems in the world today is that so many people don't plant their woody plants properly, and then they want to know, you know, what's gone wrong on down the road, right?
Absolutely.
So we needed to have somebody come in here and sort of walk us through all the steps we need to take to plant shrubs and trees properly, and, you know, also to address some of the things that when we don't do it right, some of the things that can happen to our plants along the way. So I knew just the right person to do this for us and with
north
us.
Of the river, right?
North of the river, of course, the sunny side. You know, I love my southern Indiana boys.
Yep.
But Greg Mills is here in the studio with us today. He is the New Albany City Arborist. He's, of course, a certified arborist. He's also the owner of Mills Tree Service, part of the International Society of Arboriculture. And the most intriguing part about Greg Mills is that he's the chair of their Tree Climbing Championship.
I wonder why I had the third leg.
Yes.
No, I understand.
So we'll have to find out a little bit about the Tree Climbing Championship after we get through all the really important stuff. But Greg, thanks for coming in. We appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks for having me.
Sure. You're a certified arborist, and Bob and I often talk about, you know, when people have significant tree problems, they should call in a certified arborist. What does that mean, and how does that reassure the consumer that, you know, someone is coming to their house and knows their stuff, so to speak?
Right. The certification program is through the International Society of Arboriculture,
mm-hmm.
and it is a voluntary certification program. You become eligible to take the exam based on your years of experience and education.
Okay.
The more education you have, the less field experience you need. But mm-hmm. you have to have a minimum of 2 years of field experience.
Okay. What kind of skills are you being taught as a certified arborist?
Right. That's a good question. The exam is based over 12 different domains of tree care. Everything from pruning to plant selection, establishment, of course, safety, climbing mm-hmm. techniques, all those things we need to know to properly take care of trees. And, mm-hmm. and they break it down into 12 different domains.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's not just about pruning trees. It's also about the health of the tree. And that's one of the reasons right. we have Greg in here today. As we tackle this properly, planting woody trees, woody shrubs and trees this fall. So, Greg, first off, what are the primary mistakes that people make when they're planting woody plant material?
Well, the single two things I find most often is the plant's not properly sited.
Mm-hmm.
It's not put where it's supposed to be. And then the other thing that I see all too frequently is planting depth. And if they're planted at the wrong depth, it tends to be too deep.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
What is the right depth?
You know, all a fellow would have to do is walk out in the woods or someplace where you see naturally occurring trees. And you will note there's a flare, an expanding of the trunk of the tree where it unions with the ground. And when you're planting your new tree, You need to find that flare and get that at ground level.
Mm-hmm. So often we hear plant at the same depth it was in the nursery or in the container or the B&B, but that's not always the case.
No, that's a problem. It's a problem with packaging. And, you know, as an industry, we're not wanting to point fingers at anybody and say, hey, you know, this guy over here did something wrong. Mm-hmm. But what happens is we as the consumer, when we buy this plant, be it B&B, containerized, whatever it is, we think that the top of the root system is the top of the what I call the package.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not necessarily at the top of the package. And we as the consumer and as the installer need to check into our package mm-hmm. and make sure the top is really at the top.
So what you do basically is sometimes it'll be 2 inches of stuff before the flare. Just have the homeowner remove that first.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing is I've seen a lot of horrifically root-bound plants in containers that were been in pots for 2 or 3 years. Explain exactly the best way to deal with that as a customer planting in your yard for the first time.
We've had a lot of debate with that with our local tree store organization, and there's ongoing research in it.
Right.
So it's not as simple as it would sound. When we buy a containerized plant, one of the reasons we'll purchase container over B&B is you get 100% of the root system. Now, if they're circling, and then you take the logic of, well, I'm going to cut them because they're circling,
right,
then you're defeating part of that purpose of buying that. So if I were telling the homeowner what to do, I would say endeavor to pull those circling roots apart and point them outwards, okay, away from the base of the plant.
Okay. So pull them apart, don't cut them off.
That's where I, because mm-hmm. you're going to maintain more of the root system okay. that way, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I work at that. And then actually planting the tree itself, I use a lot of water. I'll water the hole first, put the plant in there, then I'll add some water, put some dirt, add some water, put some dirt.
Right, I agree entirely. And that's one of the reasons, just like Janine said about fall planting being good. At the time of planting, you're going to layer your dirt and you're going to water it, and you're doing that to help get those air pockets out. Well, by fall planting, Mother Nature does some of that for you as well before the spring. So that's why fall is really one of your best times to plant, if for nothing else for the fact that that dirt gets to settle in and pack in well around that root ball.
Well, I think I've read the roots will continue to grow even after the tops are bare of leaves. Is that true?
That's true. According to the literature, they say anytime the soil temperature is at 40 degrees or more that you can have root growth.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking about planting depth, we're talking about holes, that sort of thing. What is the ideal way in which to dig a hole, Greg, so that you know, ensure that you're going to maintain the depth that you intended and there's no settling, et cetera?
Yeah, you ask a whole array of questions there. and what one should do is you'll measure your root ball, the depth of it, and dig to no deeper than that.
Okay.
And, of course, wider is better. You know, if some literature says 3 times the root ball, the average homeowner is not going to dig a hole 3 times wider than the root ball. It's not going to happen. But the take-home message is wider is better, and certainly try to never dig deeper than, because if you've ever had a water line installed at your house or anything like that, you'll see they'll close that ditch back in endeavor to tamp it down the best they can, and the dirt always settles.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So if you had loose dirt under your root ball that you had tried to pack down, when it settles, your root ball settles,
mm-hmm.
and your tree's planted too
deep. So planting it a little high is safer than a little low, huh?
If I had to err one way or the other, mm-hmm. I would err on the side of high, yes.
What about amending the soil, putting in some really good stuff in clay soil for a tree?
You know, once upon a time, we promoted that type of business,
right.
and now we don't. We say refill back with the native material. And I would, in my own mind, the rationale to that is, as expansive as root systems on trees are, at some point, they're going to have to go out into that native soil.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about those mistakes that you were talking about earlier that many people make, planting too deep, et cetera, you know, roots strangling around because they haven't been loosened or cut, you know, from a container. What are the long-term consequences that you find once trees start to decline?
That's part of the dilemma of our industry, actually. A lot of the things that we do that are improper If the tree would be just nice and polite and die for us when we first do that thing, it would be nice.
Not get, 10 years later when people are wondering.
Plus, you get your guarantee.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And people say there was some kind of blight.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. You know, the biggest blight is Homo sapien blight. You know. And that's the problem with, like what I'm talking about with getting that flare at the right height when you plant the tree. Does it change the tree's survivability in that first year or two? No, it doesn't. The studies show it doesn't dramatically change that. What it changes is the tree's performance 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road. So what we notice with these plants, back to answering your question, mm-hmm. that are planted too deeply or incorrectly, that they're going to decline, and it's going to take years.
In a subtle way.
In a subtle way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's also the issue of planting a smaller, like a 1-inch tree, because it'll catch up to a 3-inch tree in a couple of years anyway. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, there's truth to that. The best truth I ever personally got to see of it was when I was at the Arboretum up in Minnesota, and they had trees that had been planted. Some of them were 1-inch when they were planted, all the way up to 6-inch.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there 15 years after the fact. And I couldn't pick you out the bigger tree.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So what happens is when you move these bigger trees, you experience more transplant shock, and the tree's going to sit there longer mm-hmm. before it ever takes off.
Mm-hmm. But if we are planting these larger, are there different techniques, basically, Greg, in planting a container-grown tree versus one that's in burlap? Do we leave the burlap on versus one that's got a wire cage around it? How do we deal with the cage while planting as well?
You know, I could turn that into an hour-long talk,
mm-hmm.
but long story short is if you can plant it without compromising the root ball and get all the material off of it, that's the way it should be done.
Okay.
But it's really better not to leave the burlap on or the basket, either mm-hmm. one.
So what are some of the problems that could arise if one does?
Well, I've got some photographs to show you of some burlap that's 15 and 20 years old is still completely intact
uh-huh.
on well, the balls.
Yeah.
I mean, just regular burlap, not the plastic stuff or not the...
Well, see, that's the thing that's kind of tough because nowadays the burlap that you'll get at a nursery very well may be treated burlap. Mm-hmm.
Right. And it actually smells, yeah.
Yeah, it smells a little yeah. bit and it might look a little greenish, kind of like that treated lumber does, you know,
right.
at
mm-hmm.
your local lumber store. So to say that the material that's on there is going to decay, a lot of times they don't. And nurseries are doing that for logical reasons, because if it decayed while they're still trying to handle it,
mm-hmm.
they're going to have a handling problem.
Mm-hmm. So what about the baskets? Seems like that could be something that definitely doesn't decay. So definitely those should be removed?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, it depends whose literature you read. Everyone agrees that you're going to take it off that top 12 inches or so of the ball.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Something else that drives me nuts, I'll drive down a street somewhere like Louisville, and I'll see newly planted trees that are literally staked to death with 12 inches of mulch mounded up around the bottom, like somebody didn't know what the heck they were doing, planted that thing and left them there for 5 years. So how do you mulch? How do you stake?
Okay. We have a term for that mulching scenario.
Yeah.
We call that volcano mulching.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So when you go along and you see something that looks like a volcano, that's certainly wrong. And one of the problems that creates is something that we in the industry call SGRs, which are stem girdling roots.
Right.
And that mulch is going to create the environments that where those young undifferentiated cells at that meristemic zone are going to form roots. And then those roots are going to stay within that mulch, and they're going to circle. And as
the tree gets
bigger and the roots get bigger, the whole thing just strangles.
Uh-huh.
And back to your question of staking, we would prefer not to stake at all if you don't have to.
Right.
However, the industry is moving more and more towards container plants, and we know that. Container plants make a lot of sense. You want to carry a 150-pound plant out of your car or a 30-pound one.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they sometimes require some staking, but we need to keep staking to a minimum and for a minimum amount of time, because that movement that the tree should experience helps the trunk develop taper. And we know that it helps it develop a better root system.
Mm-hmm.
So what's your criteria? How do I know when to stake and for how long?
Well, that's kind of a judgment call.
Right.
And part of it depends on your environment. If you're in a shielded place, then you're not as apt to have to stake as you are if you're at the top of Floyd Knobs, you know, mm-hmm. where you're going to experience a lot of wind. And, you know, we like to use single staking method or double staking. And usually we will face those west to east because of the prevailing wind patterns. Mm-hmm. You know, you would stake on the west side, obviously, if, mm-hmm. if you were single staking.
Yeah. So are there staking devices that allow for a little bit of that flare or taper movement?
Sure there are. Uh-huh. I think the lady who has done a lot of research in that is Bonnie Appleton.
Right.
I think she's University of Virginia.
I think Virginia Tech.
Or Virginia Tech.
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm.
And she's done if someone wants to get and read some of the data on it.
Yeah.
But long story short, if it can move, it's better off.
And then in terms of mulching, how deep?
The take-home message on that is not any right at the base of the tree. So don't put it up against the base of the tree or the wooden part.
Mm-hmm.
As you get out away from the tree, 3 to 4 inches, something like that. You don't want to just make it super deep, but you want it deep enough to help hold in moisture.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the big thing that your mulch does is it helps cut down on that Homosapien blight that I mentioned earlier.
Keeps people away from the base of the tree, right?
Yeah,
mowing equipment,
the lawnmower blight, as Fred Wishy used to say
from
time to time. Right.
When I worked at the Parks Department, I would typically four-stake trees.
Uh-huh.
And people would ask me why, because I'd leave the straps on them real loose.
Mm-hmm.
And that was for bat wing protection.
Uh-huh. Keep people away.
Well, the mowers especially,
yeah.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. All right, Greg. So what can homeowners do? Say I bought a house. I take no responsibility for what had been done in the yard prior to, but have some plant material that, you know, is valuable. Are there troubleshooting signs that people can look for, watch, to make sure that they've got plants that are not going to be declining in 10 years after all? Are there little signs that they can tell us, whoops, maybe we can do something now to try and save this tree?
Yeah, a couple of the things that the average person can do is just note the timing of leaf development and leaf drop.
Okay.
In a tree, say if your tree is a sugar maple, look at your neighbor's sugar maple. If yours is leafing out a little late, or if it's dropping its leaves a little early,
mm-hmm.
then you have a problem and you need to bring someone in.
How about fertilizing baby trees and mature trees?
Well, fertilization is something that our industry does. You know, when you very first plant the tree, that's when you're tempted to want to do that. And we really caution you against fertilization in that first year or two after planting. You're probably dealing with a diminished root system anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And if you accidentally damage it with fertilizers are largely salts, you know, and that can be a bad thing for a plant. You know, you wouldn't go putting salt out on something on purpose. Now, as the plant gets older, it's going to depend on the environment and your management practices. The reason largely that we have to fertilize is we break nutrient cycling by taking away the leaves, and trees in the forest don't need to be fertilized.
Mm-hmm. Greg, one more question. Bob covered the whole fertilization thing. What about watering?
Watering is a very critical and largely misunderstood part of tree care. A lot of people really care so much that they want to water it every day. You know,
right.
and jokingly, I tell people it's not a puppy, you know.
Roll over, play dead, tree.
Yeah. There you go.
So what is a safe and adequate amount of moisture?
Right. Well, what we tell people to do is to approximate 1 inch of rainfall a week. That's typically what we get in Ohio River Valley here. That's what our norm is.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, watering an area much larger than just the root system of the tree is a good idea because, you know, you want to get moisture covering a large area.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I a lot of times will tell my clients to set up their sprinkler or whatever. If you don't have a rain gauge to stick out everywhere, tuna can works real well because it has straight sides,
yeah.
You know, and you can easily measure an inch in that. And water that area for an inch a week. You know, so one good soaking a week rather than watering every day.
A little bit every day,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the other really interesting thing to note, a tree that's overwatered wilts.
Yeah.
So it's the same symptom for overwatering and underwatering.
Yeah.
Now, even in these 6 weeks droughts we had with, you got a baby tree new in the ground, no rain for 6 weeks. Is 1 inch going to be enough, or do you want to maybe give it a little more?
I would give it a little more. Right. And that would have to do, too, with the time of the year that I had planted it.
Right.
You know, spring-planted trees and summer-planted trees, I would certainly give more.
Mm-hmm. But the tree will tell you. It'll wilt, you say, both ways if it needs it or doesn't.
Both ways,
need it.
Yeah. And if you're suspicious, I always tell people to use a soil probe. Mm-hmm. You'll know if you're overwatering with that soil probe.
Well, and you'll know if you're overwatering if you're overwatering. Right. Greg, thank you so much. We're so glad you came in. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Greg Mills is the New Albany City Arborist and a certified arborist. He's also the owner of Mills Tree Service in New Albany and Indiana Certification Liaison for the International Society of Arboriculture and the chair of the Tree Climbing Championship, which is held each year in
Noblesville, Indiana.
Noblesville. What time of the year is it?
We've changed it to a fall event.
Fall. So we'll have to get you back in or maybe go visit the Tree Climbing Championship sometime.
Fun.
Yeah. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. And of course, for more information on properly planting trees and shrubs this fall, please see our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, a few listener questions and a new Latin word of the week from Miss Wishy. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
Miss Wishy, we have some neat questions today. One from a lady named Faith, which kind of restores my faith. And your ability to answer questions.
Okay.
That's why you're going to get it.
All right.
This is a Miss Wishy question from Faith. What procedure is the best to ripen green tomatoes? Janine was talking about the procedure recently, which mentioned wrapping the tomatoes in newspaper. Is that the good way to go?
That's exactly what one can do to ripen green tomatoes. Basically, it's containing the gases that the tomato emits. It's not, you know, the sunlight, like putting them on the windowsill. But if you put it in a low box and, like, line the box in newspaper, rather, and then put a layer of tomatoes down and sort of crumple up the paper so you can set the tomatoes in little nests. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because you don't really want them touching each other because that could facilitate rot. Because you do need to check from time to time. They will ripen, but they may also rot. So then, you know, put a layer down, then put newspaper over top, crumple it up, put another layer down, and then just cover it with a piece of newspaper, stick it in the pantry, you know, where it's dark, and they will ripen up. And like I said, do check on them from time to time because you could get a bad apple, so to speak.
in your tomato patch?
But they really, they're not as good as vine ripened, but they're better than store-bought ripened.
In December and January, anything's better than
that. Yeah, and you know, using them in soups and other types of things too, so.
Antisocial is good. Don't let them talk to each other.
No.
When they're hidden there in the newspapers.
No, but it does work. Okay, this
one's introspective tomato. I love it.
Yes, and it does, in fact, work. This one's from Rita, Bob. Recently, my husband and I added a room to our garage with skylights and southern-facing windows. I was wondering if it would be worthwhile trying to winter over some of my annuals, like geraniums and coleus, to plant back out of my yard next spring. I know geraniums can keep growing, but she's wondering if you have any other suggestions in terms of how to use this new room that they have to overwinter plants.
This sounds like Bob and Janet Hill in fall of 2007. We did exactly the same thing. My one question, I think, is how much heat this room might have.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't say, and I think if it got below zero in there, it would change the conditions of things. But we've had tremendous amount of luck with just a little bit of heat wintering over just about everything. It stays about 50, 55.
And that's ideal, really.
Yeah, it's just perfect. So if she's got that kind of temperature, hey, go for
it. Absolutely.
And then you can even start plants inside in January and February in the sunny window with a little bit of a lamp or so forth. So it's a lot of fun. It enables you to garden 12 months of the year, which I really enjoy.
Yeah.
And I know you're good at keeping geraniums over winter. You just dig them up and tell me your magic for that.
Well, I don't do geraniums so much. I do other.
Oh, your dad did.
Daddy did. Yeah. I don't really grow geraniums anymore.
That's
so.
Right.
But yeah, I overwinter all kinds of other interesting annuals just down in the basement where, again, southern facing windows like they have. I try to keep that room relatively cool. I cut back on the watering so things can just sort of rest through the winter months. And then I kind of coax them out of their dormant sleepiness, you know, come March. And transition them back outside again.
And actually, you can get little portable heaters if this room is somewhat closed, and you can maintain above freezing temperatures.
Mm-hmm.
You can do so much in that.
Yeah.
So congratulations, Rita.
Yeah.
You're going to be a happy camper.
Go for it. All right, another question. This one's from Jim and Rita as well, but I think a different Rita. This one is, when is the best time to transplant peonies?
Actually, early fall.
Yeah.
Early to May 1st.
Right now.
Right now, yeah.
Get
and
on
I've
it.
Got to deal with this problem because I've had them in the ground for 15 or 20 years. It's the old-fashioned ones we got from family. Mm-hmm. I'm a little disappointed anymore in the flowering, so I'm sure they're just too thick.
Yeah.
So basically, you dig them up, kind of spread them out, maybe on newspapers, mm-hmm. and you want 3 to 5 buds, I think, in a division, if you're going to divide them, mm-hmm. and put them back in the ground, being very careful, very, very careful not to get more than the fabled 2 inches deep mm-hmm. on the crown, or else they're not going to bloom.
Yeah, they need efficient chilling during the winter months, so if they're planted too deeply, they don't get cold enough, basically, and they won't bloom for you very well. So no more than 2 inches beneath the soil surface.
I also read a couple different rationales for this. Somebody said they don't bloom well the first year, so just cut back the blooms anyway and let the mm-hmm. roots develop. And other people said don't bother with that and let them do what they do. But I don't know. I'll find out next spring myself.
Sometimes it takes a couple years for them to reestablish themselves.
Well, I'm sure it will,
bit.
But there might be some kind of blooms anyway.
Yeah.
But now's the time to do it.
Now's the time to do it. Okay, this one's from Reagan. Hi, guys. I have 2 huge Burney bushes in my front yard, approximately 15 to 20 feet in diameter and 10 feet high. They're shaped nicely. But they're starting to encroach on the driveway, so there's some pruning issues here. Foliage looks good on the outside, but there are some bare spots on the interior.
Yeah.
So her fear is, if they prune them back, will the foliage come back in those, you know, more balded areas on the interior?
Well, mine have, and actually, and I really like this plant. People knock it because they say it's invasive, and it is, and mm-hmm. it'll scatter around the woods and so forth, but I've got some burning bushes 8-10 feet tall that I prune up because I really like the bark. I like the limb structure. And then I do like the top being covered in this canopy of color in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
And they're kind of elegant looking when you do it that way. So yes, I prune them back and the tops have come back. And I deliberately prune the insides out because I like the structure and the mm-hmm. shape of the bush.
And they respond so well to pruning that you'll get a lot of good new growth after you prune. So don't be afraid to reduce the plant by about a third and then thin it out on the inside as well. And shape it up really any way that you want because, as I said, they respond to that pruning. And I'd probably do it the hardest, early spring before that new growth emerges is going to be your ideal time.
And mine are just elegant looking. For Euonymus, it's kind of amazing.
All right.
If you have a question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org, email us at homegrown@WFPL.org, or call us at 502-814-8246. Well, Miss Wishy, today you have some sort of circular effect on your Latin word of the week.
I do, or a glob effect.
Well, whatever works.
Yes, the Latin word of the week this week, Bob, is pilularis, pilulifera, or pilulifarum.
Yeah, and I had no idea.
Me either.
I've never heard of a plant. I guess we don't use them that much with this particular Latin attachment to it, but I like it.
Yeah, it means with little balls, referring to the globular fruits, notably of nettle.
A perfect little globular ball.
Yeah, like the little, there's a weed in my garden right now that has perfect little globular pilularis, you know, seed pods right against the stem underneath the leaves, and it's a dreadful weed. So I was inspired by that. Yeah. But yes, some plants, pilularis, pilulifera, or pilulifarum, Baccharis pilularis.
The coyote brush.
Coyote brush.
And you can see a coyote brushing by, picking up
little globular
seeds and hauling it off to the next county.
Yep. Eucalyptus pilularis.
Black butt.
Black butt, a type of eucalyptus.
Indeed.
Carex, of course, carex always comes through for us. Carex pilulifera.
The pill sedge.
Pill sedge. And you know, most sedges have that globular-like fruit anyway, right?
Yep.
But pill sedge really hits it home, don't you think?
Yeah, perfect.
Euphorbia pilulifera.
I don't like this one.
Asthma weed. Well, listen to this. Euphorbia pilulifera actually is a medical treatment that helps breathing, that helps in the treatment of asthma.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Pretty cool, huh?
Well, you stole a Bob Plant story on that one.
I did.
Yeah.
Take note of that one.
I will.
Urtica. Not Utica, but Urtica.
That was my first thought.
Urtica, pilulifera, Roman nettle.
That just sounds Roman. Somehow
it does.
The word Urtica.
It does.
Pilulifera sounds like some Roman would march by and stick that on his butt.
You know what?
And carry it off somewhere else.
Last but not least, I saved the last two to be the nettles.
Oh my God.
Onchocyphon.
You betcha.
Pililiferum.
The old stink nettle.
Stink nettle. Actually, stink nettle is a bit of an invasive weed species in the state of California.
I hope so.
So if you're in California, look for Onchocyphon, pililiferum, and you'll be face-to-face with stink nettle.
But just hold the thought of the nettle, the round nettle little ball, and
exactly.
You get the perfect image of what the
pililaris
is all about.
Or pililiferum. So yes, little balls referring to the globular fruits, notably nettle. There you have it.
Perfect.
All right. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, Ken Druce and Plantthropology. Yes, I said Plantthropology.
Yes, you did, and you even spelled it right. I'm proud of you. Homegrown is produced by the rarely stinky Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm the rarely stinky Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.